Mercy Spirituality Center presents Muffin Talk with Beate. Kia ora and welcome to a Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Ipsum. We are a center for retreats, spiritual guidance, Christian meditation and personal development. Once a week, I invite a visitor to join me in the studio to talk about our center, our program, social justice, or the Catholic Church. Today, my visitor is Hilary Lovelace. Hilary, a warm welcome and hi to my to our radio program.
Well, thank you, and kia ora, Beate.
Hilary is a trained nurse and has been working in district nursing and hospice nursing for more than 30 years. Today, Hilary also offers workshops, retreats, and one-to-one supervision. Hilary, you've been working as a nurse for many years, and today you're facilitating workshops. Would you consider this as a change of career?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because it is a change, but it's not necessarily a change on a very foundational level, because interestingly, the word career includes the word care, and I'm doing that still. That's continuing, only in a different way. So as a nurse, I was very much a doer, a fixer, someone who would rush in, see the problems, find a solution, and deliver that solution. As a district nurse, that was very big for me. Now I'm sitting with people, I'm much more opening up to them with time, which is something I didn't have as a nurse, so that I can hear their stories and their approach to life and death, and then offer them some information which might help them and some very interesting skills that they already possess in which they can use when they're going through the dying process.
So it's a little bit of also a prevention work, and you prevent them from something unexpected, or you help them finding their way.
I liken it to when I was giving birth, when I was giving my birth to my own children. I'd read books about it. I'd gone to classes where you learn to relax and breathe differently to the way we normally breathe, so you can surf the waves of the uterine contractions. But when I actually came to give birth, it was very, very different to how I'd imagined it or how people had told me. And I was able to use that knowledge from the classes and what I'd read like a map. So I was able to navigate, if you like, these strange waters that I'd never experienced before. And that helped me tremendously. And as an obstetric nurse, way back in my nursing career, I'd been with many women who were giving birth and they didn't have that information or preparation. And they just used to panic while they were giving birth. And it was a very traumatic experience for them and possibly their babies, you know.
And so you've learned out of that experience of giving life, you're helping people now to prepare.
Yes, and I must just say that the dying process, as I've observed it, very much mirrors the birthing process. Mm-hmm. So it comes and goes in waves. It's a very physical, visceral experience on a physical level, as well as all the other amazing things that we seem to be experiencing when we die on a sort of mental and possibly psychic level.
And would you call yourself an educator and facilitator in end-of-life issues? What does that mean? I think a little bit you already mentioned now, but can you tell us a little bit more about this special
Sure,
way?
Yes. So educating, to me, means imparting information, and that will come from the latest research, and there's plenty of that now on the dying process, which is very exciting. It comes from my own experiences in my career of nursing, and I must say that I would never have been able to do this if I hadn't been a nurse and had the experiences. Facilitating goes very nicely with educating, because rather than just delivering lots of information to somebody, I like to sit in a circle with people. I like to relate to my group, and I like that group energy to start up where people are sharing their feelings, their responses to the idea of dying, because it very much is an idea, you know. It's sort of in the future, but actually is it? You know, and so the facilitating is being with people in a very real and sometimes raw way,
and you lead them out of ignorance and out of maybe prejudices.
I like people to check out their prejudices and their attitudes and their assumptions and their what's been indoctrinated, you know, because there is so much. And I'll give you a little example here. When I was nursing, I was a community hospice nurse, and I called on a patient, a very old boy who was, he'd gone to live with his son and grandson, and they'd put him in the rumpus room downstairs because there wasn't any more room for him, and he wanted to die there. And I knocked on the door one day to see him, and the grandson answered the front door, and I said, "Oh, how's Pops?" because that's what he was called, and he looked very shifty. He wouldn't give me any eye contact. He looked at the floor, and "I don't know," he said, and I said, "Oh, why not? I mean, he's still alive, is he?" "Oh, yes," the boy said, and he said, "It's just I haven't seen him recently," and I said, "Oh," I said, "Is there something wrong?" And he said, "Well, I don't really know. I don't know how to be with him. I don't know what to do or say," and he was quite distressed. And I said to him, "You know, how many years have you known your grandpa?" And he said, 18 years. He was 18. And I said, "Well, you've got this 18-year-old relationship with him. Where's it gone? You know, what about your sport?" He was a keen rugby player. "Doesn't Pops want to hear about that?" So, you know, there was a lot of ignorance. And it turned out that the whole family were also staying away from Pops' bedside because they didn't know how to be with him. And this broke my heart. I thought, wow, here we are with all this incredible technology, hospice medication and fancy gadgets and things, but on a very basic human level there's something lacking. And have I got time to actually educate people out of this into how to be with the dying? And the answer was not really, because I was so busy as a nurse delivering this high technology care.
And you were very time restrained, I guess.
Very time restrained, yeah. And so now I can please myself. I can do just that by educating and reassuring people and exploring with them all these different aspects of the dying process.
Yeah. For those of you who have just tuned in, you're listening to Muffin Talk with Beate. This program is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Ipsum. If you miss any of our programs, please check out www.planetaudio.org.nz/Muffin Talk or visit our website or Facebook page at Tenganga Waiora Mercy Spirituality Center. My visitor today is Hilary Lovelace, and we were talking about the dying process. Hilary, you've been working with research into end-of-life experiences with Dr. Peter Fenwick. Can you tell us more about this research?
Certainly, yes. This was going on between 2005 and 2007, and we worked in two hospices and two nursing homes, and we were specifically looking at what we call end-of-life experiences. Now, it used to be called deathbed... Deathbed phenomena, DBP. But that sounded a bit spooky and weird, so we changed it to end-of-life experiences. And this really encompasses the interesting experiences that people tend to have, and there was not much research done on it by that stage. It's the interesting experiences that people have as they're dying, and sometimes it can be the weeks or the months or even just the days before they die. There seems to be some very non-ordinary experiences that people have. Now, there were two research studies, one back in the 1800s that was actually published in 1920-something by Sir William Barrett, and then that was very anecdotal about these experiences. And then another one done in 1959 by Osis and Haraldson, and that was an enormous study, but nothing else had been done since. So here we were, replicating in some ways some of the questions that we were asking. And in hospice, I had the pleasure of going into two hospices. And I wasn't going in as a nurse, so I was able to actually ask all sorts of questions that I knew nurses would be able to appreciate and not be freaked out by, because this was a very delicate area. For instance, when a patient sees a dead relative in the room, sitting on the end of their bed when they're dying, and they tell somebody, because it's so exciting for them, "There's my mum. Wow. Wow." Like this. That's what they say. The nurses don't necessarily take any notice of this because it doesn't fit in with the medical model. The medical model doesn't go beyond into such things. And how do we respond as nurses when the patient's having that experience? And how important is it? And do we believe them? Perhaps they've had too much morphine, etc. You know, so, and there's a lot of this. And writing it in the notes, you'd never write down in the notes that a patient had seen their dead relative sitting on the end of the bed. So this is an area which we wanted to investigate. How valid was it? What was it all about? And did it benefit anybody? We also were looking at things called deathbed coincidences, where somebody, say, in Australia, would wake up in the middle of the night, a mother, dreaming about her son who was on his OE in England. And seeing him in a bedraggled state, but he's saying, "I'm all right, Mum." And then the very next morning, she gets an email or a telephone call saying, "I'm sorry that your son was found dead, washed up on a beach in England." And she has preempted that news by having this vision, and she knows what's going on. To some extent, it may have been comforting for her because he said, "I'm all right," meaning wherever he was, you know.
Yeah, we also at the center, we also have workshops on dream work and dreams about near-death experience. And I think that's that area that you're touching now.
With, right.
Yeah.
Yes, it's Margaret Bowater.
Margaret Bowater, yes.
Had a lot of experience in that area. Yeah, she's very good.
Yeah, she's been giving workshops for a long time at our center, and we really appreciate it. So this... Dr. Peter Fenwick, he was the one who led the research?
He did indeed, yes. Yes, I was a merely humble research assistant, but I had a great deal of fun interviewing nurses and doctors. The doctors were very reluctant to talk about it. They didn't really believe it, and those who'd had experiences were questioning whether they were in their right minds at the time when they'd witnessed experiences. Some thought that, oh, it's very much a hallucination caused by the illness or by a lack of oxygen or by the drugs they were having.
And how much data did you collect? Must have been quite a lot.
It was quite a lot, although it was still considered a small study. And what we found was that they are not infrequent, these experiences. But, of course, there are many experiences that patients are having, and they won't tell the nurses because they think the nurses will think they're daft or peculiar, or perhaps they're deeply personal experiences they don't want to share. And so, yes, they're not infrequent, and they were all exclusively helpful and gave great support to that person who was dying. I'll give you another example. There was a man who was only 36 and he was dying, but he was a stockbroker. He wouldn't talk to anybody when he was in the hospice. He walled himself in and just was staring at his laptop doing his stocks and shares. And he wouldn't talk to the nurses. No one could build a relationship with him. And then one day he was just lying back. His computer was shut down. He was lying back on his pillows, smiling and wanting to talk to everybody when they came into his room. And the nurses said, "Wow, you're different. What's happened?" And he just said, as clear as anything, "Oh, well, this morning when I woke up, my dead son and my mother, who also died about the same time, were at the end of my bed saying, 'Come on, we're waiting for you. Why don't you come?' He said, 'Now I realise that I can just let go.'" And it took that to snap him out of this sort of denial, if you like.
And did he pass?
He passed away very peacefully the next day, which is very interesting.
That's amazing.
Yes, yes.
And so you have collected also other stories from different parts of the world also, or is it mainly focused on
this? This was very much in the UK, in fact, yes, just solely in the UK.
Yeah.
I believe there's research going on at this very moment here about those very things, a Kiwi research study. And I think Margaret Bowater is, in fact, going to present something with the people who are doing it in a couple of months' time. Mm. So there's something there which is quite exciting. But yes, that's to do with the unexplained side of dying, if you like. And again, my focus will include that, but it's much more to do with our own experiences that we're having on a deeply human level. And I'm not talking about religion here. I'm just talking about the human experience. And so what I'm offering to people when I'm teaching workshops and facilitating is, let's look at ourselves as human beings. Let's discover what this journey is. And then people can lay over that their religion, their religious experiences, their beliefs, etc. It sits very nicely. It's a sort of little raft, if you like, that carries things along. And so that's why I like to be available to anybody. It doesn't matter what religion or whatever they are, whether they have no religion at all. This is a human experience that we will all have.
And I understand that you're promoting an attitude of mindfully investigating our relationship with our own death and thus with life.
Yes.
And does that mean that you are trying to remind us that we need to regain a kind of culture of death in the positive sense, which allows us to better accept and deal with it rather than ignore it? Because I'm thinking of many cultures, and that includes the European culture, but a long time ago, there was a real culture of death, which you still have in, for example, when you look at Maori traditions of the grieving process, are very different to modern society. Do you think that you'd remind us of how we can deal with it and not see it as a topic that is taboo?
Well, that's one of my goals, really, is to pull this out of the closet. Let death come out of the closet. And it's not macabre in that death is with us all the time. We don't know when it's going to happen. It's with us. It's part of life. It's part of the deal. We came in and we've got to go out, you know, if you want to look at it like that.
But we are, at the moment, we are in Lent. So yes. when the priest says to us, you've come from dust and you'll go back to dust. Mm.
Yes, indeed, yes. But then some people will say, well, yeah, I know that, but how does it help me? I don't want to think about it. Like Woody Allen says, I'm not scared of dying, but I don't want to be there when it happens. You know, he'd rather be blasted out with sedatives or something, you know. And it's a little bit, it makes me think about my daughter-in-law who had the choice of a cesarean section, not because she needed it, but because she didn't want to go through labour. She didn't want that experience. So she chose, as you can in England now, to have, to go to sleep and wake up with a baby in your arms, basically. So, I mean, there are cases where people do want to just be sedated, plus, 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 and not have what's called a conscious death, and that is their choice.
But maybe they are afraid of it, as
yes,
you say.
Yes, and let's investigate this fear. And what is it? Where does it come from? Is it really true that we are frightened? Are there cultures on this planet who aren't frightened of dying? The answer is yes. Well, and when you talked about learning to accept death, I would say that accepting is suggesting that it's something in the future that we must be looking forward to accept. And I want to say, let's bring this into the now, because we could be dead in the next minute. Our life hangs on a thread, you know, our consciousness is very delicate. So why not bring it into the now? But think of it as part of life, not some figure with a skeletal figure with a scythe and an egg timer. This is something which is death, does death exist at all? What is it? Are we going to be conscious afterwards? Who knows? But let's consider the now. And if we think about dying, then we always think about life in a different way. Talk to anybody about it and they will say, yes, it's making me think this, it's making me want to do that. So there's a sort of profound effect upon people when you consider death, when you consider other people's death and even your own, that makes it even more close to the bone. And when I hear you saying, deal with it, that takes me back to nursing again, where we wanted to deal and fix and sort everything out. And I think this is, if you like, if I may say this, it's a disease of our modern Western civilization that we want to fix everything. We've got to know it all. We've got to know all about it. We can't live with mystery or the unknown. And we want to be able to say, yes, it's this big, this long, and takes this sort of time and looks like that.
It's a kind of control mechanism.
Yes, yes. And giving birth and dying are two instances where we're not in control. Okay, we have doctors and nurses helping us, but essentially the process of giving birth and the process of dying is an entity or an energy, if you like, which is beyond us. We have no control over it. And so does it say something about our need to submit or cooperate or respond to it rather than reacting and trying to fix? You know, it's coming from a different part. And the left brain and the ego are responsible for all this fixing and wanting to control. And I think we have other parts of us, which I'm sure that the Maori people and the Pacific Island people and people who are closer to their roots would appreciate the heart. And I think that in the West, in the modern European Western civilization that I've come out of, we've forgotten about the heart because the ego is in the driving seat. And there are other parts of us which we can experience and bring to life. And yes, this might prepare us for this apparent future event called death, but it also enhances our life in the now.
And so we'll have to find back our roots, because every culture has it in the roots.
We do.
The question is, what did you do with it? How big did it grow? And how much do we want to have control over life?
But our relationship with life and with death is within us right now. And it's prior to any indoctrination we've received at school or from our parents or whatever. The heart is the heart, and its response is amazing. And its capacity for love and for loving people is enormous.
Yeah. I've heard of some people working in hospices mm-hmm. saying that sometimes the relatives want to be very close to the dying person, and then they leave the room, and in that moment the person dies and they feel really guilty about
yes,
it.
Yes, yes. Yes, so that's the most common experience in our little study we did. That was the most common experience in the coincidences side, where relatives would feel gutted because they'd gone out for a coffee or to go to the toilet. When they came back, their loved one had slipped away and they felt that they hadn't been there for them. But many times the person wants to be alone when they die, and they might not communicate that. you know. And in many cases, relatives don't want to leave that person because they're frightened they'll die when they go. And so they tend to do these 24/7, if you like, vigils. And there was one instance where, when I was in hospice, where there was a family who did just that. Members of the extended family were there. They were sleeping under the bed. The person, the guy who was dying, he was only about 36, and he had two young children. And at any given time, he was never alone, which is great. But the family, after a while, they sort of let their hair down a little bit, and so they had his favourite football match going on a great big TV set that was hanging over his bed. They were playing his favourite music on a CD player on a loop that just kept going round and round. The two girls discovered how wonderful hospice beds are for trampolining, so they were jumping up and down on his bed, and there was family argument going on in the corner as well, in one corner.
He was in the middle of life.
He was in the middle of life, but he was dying, and he'd spent a long time dying, and he seemed not to be able to let go. And every now and again, a family member would come up with his favourite food, which were kumara chips, and place one between his lips. And he couldn't swallow. He was at that stage where he was emaciated. He wasn't swallowing. He wasn't drinking. He's certainly not eating. He was hardly speaking, and he was in this semi-conscious state, slipping in and out of consciousness. And the family were desperate for him to go, because they wanted him to have release, because every now and again he'd shout, "Help me, help me," and they didn't know what to do. And they asked us to finish him off, which of course we could never do. That's against the law, and it's against all ethical considerations and moral considerations. And we told them that. And they were very, very desperate, and they wanted themselves to do something for him. And so in the end, this was one evening, it was 11 o'clock in the evening, I was on duty, and I said to them, "If you really want to help him, why don't you just take a break? Give him some space. Have you said goodbye to him?" "Oh, we were always saying goodbye to him." But they weren't really saying goodbye, because they were telling him to live with all this life going on and, you know, engaging with him. I said, "Why don't you just go home and just take a night off and just completely relax, say goodbye to him and give him some space?" I said this because I'd seen the experiences in the deathbed study. It had informed me, you see. And so they did. They went home at about 1 o'clock in the morning. And when I came on duty the next morning, I'd heard that he died at 3. So after about a fortnight of just waiting and waiting and not being able to die, suddenly he had this permission. And I do believe that if we can hold death at bay for a while, if we've got people around us who are giving us their life energy almost, you know, or willing us to stay. There was one case of a man who was bleeding to death, and he was waiting for his daughter to come a long way to see him. And he lost so much blood, he was vomiting from his stomach. He lost so much blood, he shouldn't have been alive, but he stayed until she arrived. And then as soon as she was in his arms, he died. So, you know, there's more to all of this than we would ever know.
And each dying process is different, whereas the one needs a break from the family to be able to go. The other one was waiting for the family to come.
That's right, yes. So we're all different. Every death is unique. And we have to be open to that as carers of the dying. And so I also teach people to care for their dying as well.
So that's what you do in your workshops. Mm-hmm. You're creating that awareness and educating people on how to deal.
How to respond,
And are you working mainly with people who are caregivers, or are you also working with nurses?
I'm aiming to touch the public. I really want to speak to ordinary people on the street, the public, who will always come into touch with dying in some way. At the moment, I have a lot of caregivers and a lot of professionals coming to my workshops, but I'm just creating a website, and so I hope to have a bigger presence out there so that people know about me. And yes, but I really would prefer to be talking to the public.
Well, I think that a caregiver can also be a person who is part of the family,
of
who
course.
Is not a professional caregiver,
yes.
And just for that time and needs some support.
Absolutely, and that's the people I'm aiming to support.
Yeah. And what experiences, you've been a nurse and you've been together with people at different stages in their lives, what experience do you think has formed you most?
Gosh. Well, again, working in hospice and seeing people dying has had a huge effect upon me. That's shaped what I'm doing now, but it's also been informed by giving birth and also working in an obstetric unit, watching people giving birth. So, but the whole of my nursing career has formed me, if you like.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much, Hilary. Thank you for coming to the studio. And I wish you all the best. And you will have some workshops at the Mercy Spirituality Center.
Absolutely.
In the future. And so we can look at our website and you'll find out more about it.
Yeah, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Kiora.
And to our listeners also, what is coming up in our Spirituality Center? From Thursday, the 22nd of February, to Thursday, the 22nd of March, we will have our Lenten Talks with Father Stuart Seller. Last year, he gave a series of 4 Lenten Talks. This year, he has enhanced it to 5. And all sessions this time will be in the evening. And on the 27th of February from 7 to 9 p.m., Rangi Davis will come and give a presentation on reconnecting broken connections using one Te Ao Māori approach of Akawanongatanga and Ho'orongo. And even though it might sound complicated if you don't speak Māori, but the presentation will be in English and we'll certainly find a wonderful sense of connectedness on that evening. On the 2nd of March, we will have Eamon Butler with us for the first time. He will explore the spiritual reflections by Henry Nouwen on Rembrandt's painting of the Return of the Prodigal Son, Friday, the 2nd of March, from 10 to noon. And on the 7th of March, we'll have Sister Elizabeth Snedden. She's going to present a muffin meeting on the topic Discerning the Threads of Connectedness from 10 o'clock to noon. As you see, our theme for this year is connectedness. And also, please remember that we'll have the public submissions coming up about the end-of-life choice bill. And the closing date for the submissions is midnight on Tuesday, the 20th of February, 2018. If you haven't put in your submission of what you feel is right, then please do it. And if you had already put in your submissions last year, please do it again, because this is a new count. Thank you very much. And if you have any other questions or want to register for our events, please call us at Auckland 09-638-6238 or contact us via our website at www.mercyspiritualitycentre.org.nz. I wish you all a blessed Friday and a good week ahead. Thank you.